Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 74, where Tom, Leonardo, and Jared are discussing Alfred Chandler's award-winning book, The Visible Hand, The Managerial Revolution in American Business, published by Belknap Press in 1977. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
I thought we could now discuss maybe some of the market distorting effects that large organizations and players can have on an industry. It's something that the book kind of brushes over. In fact, it does the opposite. It says that these large organizations are incredibly efficient at coordinating commerce. And Tom, in the last part of the episode, you mentioned different legislation and how that protected perhaps some monopolistic activities. But now this is something that I guess we deal with on a day-to-day basis, is that these really large modern enterprises, I mean, maybe we're in modern enterprise 2.0 stage, are able to, because of their scale and some of their almost their expertise in that kind of managerial dimension, that they can influence market activities in ways which maybe Chandler couldn't foresee in the late 1970s.
Yeah, that's a very good good point. The legislation, you know, that we were talking about before was, you know, trying to prevent monopolistic behavior. So what happens typically when these sorts of things happen is then people start to find new and exciting ways to try to get around the law. And so, in the times after Chandler, I mean, I think about the battles that, like, for example, Microsoft had to face for so many years. And they're not alone, but just think about what in reality makes a monopoly. When we're talking about in the time of where Chandler is writing the history, in a vertical integration sense, a monopoly is basically something that controls the whole supply chain from raw material to product given to the consumer. And if you own all of that and you squeeze out competition, well, we can say that that is bad. Now, what does that mean in a software, you know, in a different type of an industry? I mean, just about all of the industries that Chandler was writing about are, you know, the products were physical, tangible, had to be made, okay? And now a lot of the businesses or a lot of the enterprises that have come afterwards, now it's information, applications, it's different types of technologies that they're not as tangible. So it's different.
Yeah, it's interesting because this kind of, by the end of the book, Chandler discussed these things about the suspicions that American society had or have, still have, on these giant, large corporations that first these large companies, it's a harm to democratic values. Their managers are not accountable and they didn't allow competition, the economic competition, the new business to flourish. So it's like kind of the same discussion that we have today, as Thomas it's mentioned. When a company, that large tech company that we don't need to mention, buy another one that's kind of competition, they buy the competition. So it's interesting how, because Chandler say, well, maybe Chandler was saying that this kind of integration back then was necessary because of this coordination. So it's something that would add to the actual operation of this company. But today, maybe we're seeing something a little different, that we are buying competition and we are building this empire that nobody can harm.
Well, I think what's fascinating is, you know, in line with what you're saying there, is that middle management went from being this very important entity that, you know, by the end of Chandler's history, that middle management was a very critical, played a critical role. And ever since then, it's been the opposite. It's been middle management has been seen as intensely bureaucratic in the way. And also, you know, to your point about how, you know, companies buy their competition and that sort of a thing. I think in a couple of instances, you know, Chandler talked about how in the mergers, what do you do with, you know, the two staffs? Well, in a lot of ways, a lot of his stories in part four, the staffs were, well, they weren't exactly additive to each other, but they were complementary. You needed to have company A buying company B. Company A's staff, middle management, was needed to coordinate what company A was doing. And company B's former staff was needed in order to cover what company B was doing. And so the ultimate, you know, the middle management was something not too far off from, say, the sum of company A's and company B's. Now, in times since Chandler, I'm definitely not qualified or definitely don't have a lot of direct experience in this. I can only talk secondhand. You know, that sort of thing was not happening by, say, definitely the 1990s, where it was more like when company A bought company B, company B's management went bye-bye. Something closer to that. And, you know, this is also a time when in Chandler, bureaucracy was like, say, you know, Weberian bureaucracy, which was a good thing. It was there to coordinate. It was there to routinize. It was there to enhance the organization. And then come, you know, after Chandler, it is, it's a roadblock. It's a organization designed to say no. It's something that has to be cut out. It's a waste of money because middle managers, because they're professional, professional in a negative sense, they are expensive. And they were seen as like, you know, waste of manpower and an impediment to efficiency, a total opposite. Definitely the attitudes changed. And at the same time, we started to see kind of like, you know, I don't want to say the disintegration, but a number of the industries that Chandler was talking about here in the book that were on the ascendancy or were established come the 1970s are practically shadows, or you know, barely shadows of their former selves now, if they exist at all. Let's, you know, some of the ones that he's talked about, Sears, Roebuck, the department store chain, United States Steel. You could go down the list and say how things have gone the other direction ever since the publication of this book. It'd be interesting to see somebody actually sort of like write a Chandler 2.
Yeah, it's hard to know why firstly, I don't know what the popular conception or thinking about middle managers was back then, but definitely there's a lot of connotations associated with middle managers now. And I mean, some of them, I'd say a lot of them are unfounded. I think a lot of middle managers do fantastic work in a lot of organizations. But for some reason, they are seen as this group stranded in no man's land. I know there's a publication by Kui He, which talks about how middle managers are required to walk this tightrope between upper management and the front line. And it really can be a fraught position for them as they seek to juggle different expectations of their managers and reconcile them with, I guess, the challenges that employees have facing on the front line. You know, they don't fall nicely into either category. They're kind of the outsider to upper and managers themselves. I wonder if one of the propositions that Chandler has in the book, in fact, it's, what number is it if people want to look it up? It's, I think, proposition 5, that these salaried managers became increasingly technical and professional, something we touched on in the first part of the episode. Training became longer and more formalized. And perhaps, you know, for a period, this training was something which middle managers enjoyed. But I guess with the proliferation of higher education around the world, it's not just middle managers who are becoming professional and technical in the late 1900s. It's a lot of more frontline workers as well. The number of people who've been trained in management is always on the increase. So what advantage does a middle manager have over a, I don't know what we want to call them, a frontline manager?
Well, what I wonder is what value was middle management in the days of, say, the emergence of the PC industry with the Microsofts and those sorts of things, where an entire multi-billion dollar enterprise could be set up in somebody's garage. I mean, the whole idea of this is getting where the difference between coordination for tangible goods is different from intangible goods, because or intangible things. Because there in the Microsoft world, it didn't make sense to have that kind of middle management necessarily, at least not initially, because so much like software development is far more efficient with very, very small teams and without a whole lot of managerial interference. That was certainly my experience when I was working in software way early in my professional career, was that the whole idea that you would have this, there was nothing really for the managerial layer to do, because software development did not follow the cost models. It didn't follow distribution models. If it didn't really follow the distribution models before, when you had, when distribution was done using diskettes or, hard actual physical objects, it certainly doesn't. Now that everything is downloadable directly to your PC without the need for any physical object to be passed around. So there's sort of like the aspect of, for certain industries, they just don't serve a purpose, or they didn't serve an apparent purpose, or maybe they needed to be repurposed. And then the other aspect, of course, about them getting in the way, one of the things that struck me about the early days, that Chandler talks about, what did managers do during that time? They actually made decisions. They were actually making decisions. They were deciding about flows. They were deciding about new markets. They were empowered. And the sense that I had from the 1980s or whatever was that somehow that power had diminished over time. Maybe this was because around Chandler's time was when a lot of these industries started to fall into some harder times. And in that particular instance, well, maybe the top managers were taking a little bit greater interest in lower level activities, Go ahead.
Yeah, I just thinking that maybe I can add what you say with the question, how many middle managements a computer can replace?
Yeah.
Because when Chandler said about the importance of this middle management, is I think the central one of the they are making decisions, they are thinking about market, but they are coordinating the flow of information. They are coordinating how the information came through the organization and how this is stored and interpreted. This is what something that is interesting, how maybe the importance of this function in organizations today is more, things are more automated, so you don't need that large staff. This is not new, but Red Chandler, see how important this was, and now how this was threatened by some kind of device that is more efficient than they are. So all the problems that come with this, that I think we can talk about a little about the bright side of this middle management. Just to mention, because all the work by Gerald Davis showing this kind of importance of how these giant organizations for employment in the United States, and now how the kind of fall of the giant organization is related with the rising inequality in the world, not only in the United States, but here, a place where this kind of large structures of employment exist.
Yeah, I think to also touch on some of the, not to give middle managers too much of a bad rap, I mean, there's lots of research which discusses the sense-making role that middle managers play in organizations, and the translational role they play in terms of translating strategy into more concrete activities for their direct reports and so on. So, and having been a middle manager myself, I know, you are in some ways the foot soldiers of the executives. And in a way, you can also, being the foot soldier, also be the fall guy. Yeah, I empathize with the middle managers.
Well, why don't you... Can you tell us a little bit about, kind of like, you bring up an excellent point about strategy, because in a lot of ways in the modern times, how much of that really is done by middle managers nowadays? We talk about how, like, a lot of the routine actions of middle management has been routinized to the point of being automated in some ways or subsumed. But what might be an example of how there's something lost, say, on the development of strategy by the marginalization of middle management?
The first thing I think about is how strategy, the traditional conceptions of strategy, have changed and almost become more democratized. It used to be considered the domain of the executive function, the most senior people in an organization. But I mean, there's a big trend towards more inclusive strategy making and open strategy. So in some ways, it's not only have middle managers been swept up into that, but frontline workers to a degree as well, and even sometimes external actors. So on the one hand, yes, I think I would say that who develops formal strategy is changing. Another perspective on it is that strategy is not something that you have in a document or written on the website or the wall. Strategy is what people actually do in practice. And so, I mean, this is something that I know from my own research, coming from a strategy as practice perspective, which views strategy in terms of what people do rather than something an organization has. And so if you want to point towards or ask the question, what is the strategy of an organization? I'll point you towards what people are actually doing. And I'll say, well, there's the strategy in action. And that's another take. But middle managers, and for, you know, my experience is the senior executives will develop some strategic objectives, and then it's your role to try and translate that or make sense of it for your direct reports, but also translate it into some sort of action which the frontline can then connect to the overall direction of the organization. So it's how do you help the frontline connect what they are doing with the overall kind of purpose of the organization as well.
Yeah, I guess that what that strikes to mind is even a different sense of what strategy is than, say, what I might think of it as. Because and the reason why I say it is because you're right. In the context of strategy as practice, the role of the middle manager is fairly limited. If you're focused on thinking or equating the strategy of an organization in terms of what an organization is actually doing, in essence, your time horizon of your strategy is very, very limited. You're really thinking very, very short near term. You're thinking about the future of the organization in terms of small steps or iterative steps. Whereas from another sense, the strategy is something that is supposed to transcend that to something that really is like long term. Now, I agree, it can devolve into, you know, fancy looking charts posted up on a wall that say absolutely nothing. It says, this is where we're going to be in 5 years. And nobody believes a word of it, but it sounds good. You know, convince stakeholders you're thinking about something more than next fiscal quarter. But it ultimately doesn't actually drive the direction that the organization is going. In the strategy from a long-term perspective, middle management plays a much greater role because there's a lot more uncertainty involved, I think, or a lot more need for assessing risk, seeking opportunities, and that sort of thing. Whereas when you pull back to sort of a shorter term, and I do believe that the modern information technology, you know, the modern information enterprises really lends themselves to nearer term perspectives, because it's not necessarily about where you want to be in 5 years from now. Your enterprise may not exist 5 weeks from now. It's a whole different time horizon that we're talking about. And I sort of see that as a definite contrast to the way that Chandler showed with the building of the industrial enterprises, because there the strategy, even though there was such tremendous change going decade to decade, there were very long-term horizons kind of built into the managerial thinking in terms of, okay, within the next 2 to 3 to 4 years, we're going to expand our production, or we're going to expand our, we're going to set up all of these offices or branches, like with the banks and things like that all over the place. And there's a bigger picture of what that's about that seems to be absent.
Yeah, I think this point around the time horizons is an interesting one to talk about in terms of how Chandler views it. And I mean, I keep coming back to these propositions that he sets out at the beginning of the book. But number 7, it says that career managers preferred policies that favored long-term stability and growth of their enterprises to those that maximize profits. And I read that and I thought, this guy is definitely in a different century to me, because my view is it's a complete opposite. Managers are preoccupied with the short term. How do we, I mean, almost a little bit like politicians, you know, how do we get through to the next election and we're not thinking much beyond that? Yeah, it's definitely a different time. I mean, maybe still in the late 70s, people were having a 25, 30 year career in the one organization, but that's long gone. But in some ways, I can see the argument. If you do have a middle manager layer who are committed to the organization for a long time, I can definitely see the benefits of that in terms of the stability and the kind of future planning and the long-term strategy setting, Tom. And it reminded me of, I remember I had an undergraduate law lecturer who was, I forget the course, but it was something on different legal structures. And this particular lecturer of mine was an advocate of the constitutional monarchy as a form of government, because he said you basically had the best of both worlds in that you had a government or an elected government that would come in, but you also had the stability of a monarch who had the long-term interests of the country in mind. I mean, probably it was maybe overstating some of the issues. We don't want to get into a debate about the monarchy, but I could see how in Chandler's view, these managers provided that same sort of stability and kind of direction setting over the long term. But it's definitely something that I think is a relic now of the last century, because we don't see that anymore.
Yeah, and I also, it sort of reminds me of the 1990s in particular, when in the advent of such tremendous change, because the internet was becoming a thing and we were starting to come to grips with it, how that sense of stability or continuity really was starting to be viewed as complacency, as resistance to change. That is that managerial layer, whether this was deserved or not, was perceived as an impediment. You know, they were trying to fight for keeping things the way they were. That was what was sort of charged against them. And so that was yet another reason why we had to start cutting at this reticent middle layer and streamline, right size. I think that was around the time that the whole term right size was founded. Because it started with downsize, which was sort of like precipitous cuts. And then we started to realize, we're breaking organizations doing that. Now let's go at it at a proper way. It's still the same thing, really, when you get down to it. But, this whole issue of, you know, we want to value continuity, stability in order to ensure consistency or, you know, predictability from the view of the customer. But on the other hand, if continuity becomes continuity for its own sake, it becomes complacency, it's bad, and we have to contend with it. And I guess now where we're at now is we're seeing sort of like the pendulum the whole other way, where we're so accustomed now to thin middle layers, we don't see the same value that Chandler saw when he wrote this book.
Yes. And that, I think, showing what I said, showing how by... I don't know the exact figure, but maybe the big corporations was the great employment in the United States by the 1950s. And maybe the half of the United States was indirectly or directly employed by the large corporations. So, and then this thing fell apart, and there is some kind of complaint about the kind of nostalgia about that time where everybody got jobs and family jobs and so on. On the other hand, I think it's interesting because the idea is different. You are saying about all the Jerry say, oh, this is from another century. And I was thinking that organizational chart, that is something that doesn't exist anymore. And Chandler is showing all the role and how that today, if you show that for someone, for some audience, everybody would say, no, this is something that will cut my creativity and I will get stuck in this. So it's a kind of prejudice, I think. It's strange how things change.
Well, we always have to be careful with nostalgia because we love to remember the good things about something and forget about the bad. There was definitely some downsides to the way, you know, to the state of employment back in those days that we tend to forget when we say we want to go back to those days. Most notably, workplace safety. I mean, you know, the workplace safety has come a long way. It definitely is something that a company has to invest in order to ensure that working conditions are safe. I also remember, well, maybe this isn't quite the same, but it's also another bit of counter nostalgia. Environmental concerns. I mean, one of the things that Chandler definitely did not get into was what havoc that industrialization wreaked on the environment. He touched on it maybe a tiny bit, you know, here and there, but, you know, it certainly was not part of this history, but certainly was a part of what had happened as the, you know, industrialization matured. I lived in a blue-collar section of the country where if you wanted to know what day of the week it was, you looked at what color the river was based on what they were dumping into it. It's very, very different now. One of the things that I think that is sort of like an outgrowth of now trying to reconcile, you might want to say, the sins of industrialization is, you know, yeah, it's also become a lot more expensive to be in this business. And so now Modern Factory, the episode we did, you know, a few months ago, where, you know, in the end, the factory that we observed in this documentary began, you know, going with automation, robots and things of that nature, not just to, you know, to cut down on the human costs, but also to ensure efficiency. And there, if you're automating, you know, like when we think about what are middle managers coordinating, you know, a lot of what they were coordinating is people and people-oriented processes. And if you take that away and you give a lot of the frontline work to robots, then do you need as many middle managers?
Yeah, we touched on this a little bit in part one where we said that, you know, Chandler takes a fairly neutral approach to the technology. In fact, we might say he valorizes it. And I mean, that's one of the criticisms of the book is the technological determinism of the approach. And there's no, I guess, yeah, critique of the impact of these technologies. I mean, as Tom, as you said, I mean, the book goes into quite some detail, but it also, I think, skims over a lot of the messiness of the growth of the railway system. I imagine the messiness of the development of cost accounting. I mean, that couldn't have just happened overnight. I mean, there must have been a lot of a lot of mess involved there. And around the time that the book was published, I mean, this was when people started to maybe critique in more detail some of the or take more a critical perspective on the role of technologies and, yeah, not only in terms of environmental impacts and you said on maybe social impacts in terms of factories and so on. And I mean, I can't help but move ahead now to think about algorithms and some of the perhaps perverse effects that they might have on modern enterprise and modern economy as well. So I'm not sure what your thoughts are there.
There's a kind of discussion too in the 80s about how the size of this corporation was the cause for their inefficiency. And you start to discuss all the small is beautiful thing about the size of the company. So you start the discussion about this, like Tom said, about the garage thing, the idea that the United States manufacturing have to pass through the second industrial divide. So that's the name of the book, was some kind of, it's an interest book that say that the idea was move from that large giant corporation to something like a putting out system that it were more efficient because it will be more, you can customize things, that thing that the corporation didn't have the chance. And this is from the 80s, but now we see this kind of discussion again in manufacturing. Because all the data, you can discuss, all the artificial intelligence thing, you can put in the production, so you can predict all the demand that you have for your product. With this discussion that we are saying today, that the technology are made available to us, middle management will not grow again. will be not necessary, because all the idea of demand, supply and demand will be you have data instead of middle management. It's more efficient to have a good data analysis than a bunch of middle management.
Well, I want to offer a different take on that, because as I think about it, you know, one of the functions of middle management that I think was prevalent in Chandler's time, but I don't think it was something that Chandler was looking for and therefore didn't pick up on it. But I think that, one of the roles of professional middle management is to protect the organization from itself. And it's basically to sort of be some sort of a stopgap against mistakes, against unethical behavior or other sorts of things. Any sort of an industry or any sort of new way of doing business, we have to be careful about how excited we get in the first few years. The impacts don't get always felt right away. And I do think that some of that was in the episodes in which our podcast addressed algorithmic management. We're pretty clear on raising the criticisms of it. I was not part of those particular episodes, but they're definitely available. Let's just say about what's going on right now with social media companies. Because a lot of the social media companies, for example, go back to Chandler. One of the things that as these multi-unit business enterprises formed, what did they do on the consumer side? It included salespeople. It was when you developed service contracts to say that, all right, you buy our vacuum cleaner, you buy our range, you buy our whatever, you know, domestic machine kind of thing. Then you get service from our people and you have a phone number you can call to talk to a human that says that I need repair, I need help and that sort of thing. And then they respond. Now, what's happened since then, especially in the days of the internet, and especially in terms of social media, the whole idea of what customer service is has changed. As a matter of fact, customer service in the information age was seen as like an unwanted expense, a hassle for the company, to the point where there are some of the big social media not just social media, but other tech giants simply do not have any human interaction in their customer service, because not only is it expensive, it is very inefficient. You're talking about, for your typical tech call issue, what have you, it is potentially an hour of an expert on the phone with an individual customer, a single individual customer. That's an incredible expense. What's the other side of that story, though? Growing frustration with customers who can't get help. In an algorithmic management sense, where the decisions, you know, like basically supervisory decisions are being made by a computer with only so much context, with only so much ability to inference. Even with AI, you have issues with AI learning mistakes or learning biases into the algorithm. Now what's happening is that we're starting to recognize the downside. So does this mean that we got to ratchet back a bit? We got to think about what coordination functions have we forfeited or what ones have to be created from whole cloth to say that we need, you know, somewhere in here, there's got to be a smarter way to get the human in the loop to handle those things that just simply can't be addressed through an algorithm, whether it's an algorithmic, whether it's an online agent chat window or some other thing that basically says this particular thing is beyond the capability of the machine to be able to handle. We've got to get the human in there to get to the bottom of it. I'm not necessarily totally cynic about what AI can do. There's a pendulum swing here. You know, there's only so much where coordination's, you know, there's coordination that's got to be done. So,
no, sure. I totally agree with you. I think that maybe what is missing in all this, let's say, hope for their artificial intelligence to solve all our problems, it maybe is what Chandler says about the middle management, what the what's the functions of it? Maybe what's lacking in a discussion of artificial intelligence inside organizations, and what I think what's maybe is happening in companies that are already it's developed this kind of technologies, and I think they have this, is this idea of putting this technology in service of the organization in a proper way. This only could be made if you have some kind of middle management, like Chandler said, not the middle management, but all the functions of the understanding of the organization, the understanding of the market, how you can prove your organization with technologies, how you can grow. I think this kind of functions never gets old, and this kind of function never will be replaced by computers.
It's all very, very interesting, because the I joked before, I think, about Chandler too, but something like that probably does need to be taken up as a project at some point, because I do think the value of the book is to show the emergence of an institution that at the beginnings, and now what we've been talking about here in this part has been sort of like the maturation of it, and in some way, to a point, its demise. And I think there's some lessons in that, because I don't think it's ever going to really go away. We're going to find new and interesting reasons to try to preserve this type of a function, because ultimately, it's all about information flow, communication, coordination, collaboration, of trying to connect production and distribution, whether it's a thing or it's something intangible like an idea or a song or an app or what have you. There's always going to be room for that sort of a thing, and it's an evolutionary thing. It's going to come and go. It's going to redefine. It's going to go with the times, and we can say here that we don't see a future necessarily that would restore the level of middle management that may have been in the time of the great industrial enterprises, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. And I think that the way in which Chandler laid out the founding, the principles of what it was that this middle management was to do in order to provide particular expertise, administrative control, and all of that, that in order to relieve the burden of the ownership from shorter term day-to-day operational tasks, there's always going to be room for that to come back in some way. It's just right now we're seeing it as sort of the low end. So in that regard, it was worth reading the whole book, and I certainly recommend it to anybody who is working in this sort of arena.
Well, first thing, it's maybe something that we got used to, just to say that institutions matter, but we have a few comments and research about how institutions can come to life, how they appear and how they evolve. And Chandler is very interesting how institution evolves. So it's a painful, not an easy reading, but it's something that you follow the thought how he constructs this idea of an institution growing and changing the market and changing all the economy of a country at scholarship. That it's very impressive. To finish with the ideas that we are discussing by now, and it's important, I think it's important to stress the importance of this kind of role in the organizations of people who are there planning things and trying to make decisions based on data and on facts. And so I think this is important, and maybe today more important because we have this kind of plenty of data about the organization, about customers. The idea to think about in long range, it's very important, not so because we have maybe more tools now that this heroic middle management of Chandler that I had before.
Yeah, the book covers a lot of territory, and we have perhaps focused more on the management aspect of that, and particularly the emergence of the middle managers, which is not surprising given our kind of focus of the podcast. I think what Chandler does very interestingly is provide an explanation for the growth of the profession of management. Prior to this, to be a manager was considered a profession, but definitely afterwards, it with the accompanying all the dimensions of the emergence of a profession with training and business schools and so on, we saw that come afterwards. And in a way, he does a really interesting, great job of documenting how a new form of institution emerged so quickly. It was hundreds of years. I mean, we touched on it earlier in the episode, but things didn't change for a long time in terms of the structure of the economy, you know, not majorly. But then all of a sudden it changed really quickly, in part because of the technological developments. And so it was a quick rise, but in some ways it's also been a quick fall, because middle managers do not have the same level of preeminence in society and our discourse as they did at the time of Chandler's writing. I mean, that's not to say that middle managers are not important, but we definitely don't think of them in the same way. And so, yeah, it would be really interesting, as Tom said, to have a Chandler 2.0, and particularly to hear his thoughts would be really amazing, to reflect on how things have changed so quickly in the last 50 years or so. But yeah, a great book, and really thankful to have the opportunity to read it, I guess the encouragement to read it, and to discuss it with you guys today.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback. So if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.